I'm John Wells with Cool Science Radio.
I'm Tim Henney with The Mountain Life.
Tim and I, we really don't have that much in common.
Yeah, for example, I'm good-looking and he's not.
And I wrote Alfred E. Newman in for city council. Tim, he voted for himself.
But there is one thing we both have in common, our most excellent co-host, Lynn Ware Peak.
Ah, today is her 50th birthday.
Happy birthday, Lynn.
Only in Park City.
Only on KPCW.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my guest co-host, Chris Cherniak, while Tim Henney is, of course, on assignment. It's snowing outside, or at least kind of snowing, and one of the things we like to do each year about this time is to go deeply into the subject of avalanches. Joining us first will be the executive director of the Utah Avalanche Center, Paul Daigle.
And good morning, and happy half century, Lynn.
Thank you. I'm still red from that great promo
that
John and Tim did.
Well done, John and Tim.
What a surprise.
After Paul will rebroadcast one of our favorite interviews this fall, it's with Sean Foy with the Burst Workout. This guy brings to life and practice the benefits of high-intensity workouts, raising metabolic rate, targeting all the major muscle groups, and so on.
This is
all the things you need.
Oh, yeah. Now that I'm 50.
True. Okay.
Yeah, thanks.
We'll talk more about that later.
We will. This is The Mountain Life, only in Park City, only on KPCW. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Executive Chef Chris Sheehan from Park Meadows Country Club here, supporting KPCW. We offer regionally inspired cuisine such as pine nut crusted filet of sole for dining inside or outside. Our dining venues are also ready for any occasion, and golf, social, and dining memberships are also available. 649-2460 or on the web at parkmeadowscc.com.
The Park City Chamber Bureau will host its annual Winter Kickoff Mixer and Activities Expo on Thursday, December 4th from 5 to 7:30 p.m. at Park City Mountain Resort's Legacy Lodge. The Winter Kickoff Mixer showcases Chamber Bureau members who provide winter season activities, entertainment, and events. There will be free food, beverages, swag, numerous prize drawings, and a cash bar. This fun annual event is free and open to the public. For more information, please contact the Nonprofit Chamber Bureau at 649-6100.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my guest co-host, Chris Cherniak. Well, every day during the winter, across the state, every mountain range, the Utah Avalanche Center is out there being the watchdogs for us, keeping us safe from forecasting to, oh gosh, free talks and lectures all across the state, getting into the schools and teaching our school children. The Utah Avalanche Center is out there really trying to inform and educate us about the dangers of avalanche and a little bit about snow science. And joining us in the studio is the executive director of the Utah Avalanche Center, Paul Daigle. Good morning to you, Paul.
Thank you, Lynn. Good morning and welcome to being AARP eligible.
Uh-oh. Yeah, that's the hard part about today.
Ouch.
But at least you guys have gone through it before me, so.
Yeah. And we'll share with you just the joys of that later in the show.
Okay. Sounds great. Well, we always like to have you on, Paul, about this time of the year to talk. You know, every morning at about 8:05, we have one of the Utah Avalanche Center forecasters call in and give us the scoop on the day. And, you know, it's crucial. In fact, it's obligatory that anyone going out in the backcountry really stays abreast of what's going on and listens to the forecast and looks up your site and calls the center. And but you're here today to, we'll go a little bit into, well, a lot about avalanche in general, but why don't you start off by telling us what those forecasters do when they wake up and what is the day in the life of a forecaster?
Well, the forecasters lead sort of dual lives. On the days that they are actually forecasting, when you talk to them on the phone, when they're putting out the online forecasts, they're actually arriving at our office at the National Weather Service by the airport at 3:30, between 3:30 and 4:30 in the morning, to go through all the reports from resorts, from control work, from the highway crews, from observations from the day before, to put out forecasts by 7 o'clock in the morning. So the days that they are not in the office, they are typically out in the field. They're wandering around on skis or by snowmobile. They're digging snow pits. They're looking for signs of recent avalanche activity. They're talking to people, looking at the weather models, and trying to figure out what the next day's forecast is going to be.
And do they do any avalanche control work, or do they leave that up to the resorts?
That is left up to UDOT and the resorts. Mm-hmm. The Utah Avalanche Center is responsible for everything in the state outside of highway corridors and the resorts, and that's way too big to control.
Yeah, absolutely. So then does the Utah Avalanche Center give information to UDOT, for example, or do they have their own forecasters?
Yes, they do have their own forecasters, and we trade information every day. They have multiple forecasters around the state. We tell them what we're seeing. They tell us what they're seeing, and we work on forecasting together.
So what's the primary data that they're analyzing and compiling? What's the really important information they're looking at each morning?
I'd say the biggest three pieces of information are, first of all, weather data. They look at automated weather stations from around the state. The second is they go out and dig around in the snow, and they look for weak layers, and they look for big slabs on top of those weak layers. And the third is they look for recent avalanche activity, and they listen to the public. They hear what other people out in the field are seeing.
Oh, so is there an opportunity for citizens to call in or email in information, some citizen science type of activity?
Absolutely. We depend on our observers. We have some paid observers in the field, but we have lots of volunteers. We accept information from the public. And if you go to our website, there is a spot for submitting a backcountry observation. Mm. And we depend on those. That's part of what makes Utah's avalanche forecasting so special compared to the rest of the world, is we were really the first to encourage the public to give us our information and use that. We get enough of it that it's pretty high quality.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So you never worry about some false kind of information coming in, or do you come to, I suppose, rely on people who often submit?
Right. I mean, it's our job to worry.
Yeah.
But we have regular submitters. We know to trust them. If we get an outlying observation, it's pretty obvious because we get enough information each day.
How does the media here do in helping you cover this story?
Oh, the media is great. We couldn't do our job without the media.
Right.
We have a Twitter feed that all the local media channels follow. Anytime anything interesting is going on, an accident, changing conditions, we tweet it. We instantly get phone calls from the media wanting to know more details. We get interviewed a lot. That's the way we get the message out to a lot of people. And we really need that because the hardcore backcountry users, they come to us already. They know to come listen to our forecast. The people we really worry about are the ones that don't consider themselves hardcore users.
Right. Who are the people that most often get buried by an avalanche?
Well, we really see two different types. We see people that really know what they're doing and they just choose unwisely and they get caught. But more commonly and more tragically, we get people caught that really don't know that they're even exposed to risk. It's like if you'd never seen a freeway before and you decided to walk across one, suddenly you're at a lot of risk and you may not realize it.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I think a lot of people might not know that the Utah Avalanche Center was a recipient as one of the many, many nonprofits with Live PC, Give PC, and also the Vail Community Grants. You're one of, I don't know how many, but maybe one of the only that people would think, oh, they're an organization down in the valley. They're not local, but really your work is so very local here on the Wasatch Back.
Well, we forecast all over the state, but I'd say it's especially critical here on the Wasatch Back. You know, from the studio windows here, we can see some really dangerous avalanche terrain. It happens that the Wasatch Back, because of the way the mountains are laid out, has a lot of avalanche danger. The ski resorts put a lot of effort into controlling that. to mitigating it by throwing bombs and closing runs. But when you leave a resort gate, or if you go out in the Uintas, you are suddenly in a very different world, and you're at risk of an avalanche accident.
Yes, so talk about that, if you would, the legality of why it is that they can't close those gates, for example, at Canyons Resort. Why can't they close them?
Well, in the first place, because of law, you can't close off access to the National Forest, with a few exceptions, but...
If you're on a snowboard at Alta.
we're not going to talk about that this morning. But in general, you can't close off access to public land. And that's where a lot of people enjoy recreating. I mean, part of our mission is to get people out enjoying their public land.
So the best the gates can do is just kind of serve as a message that you're entering a high-risk area. If you're not well-equipped, we prefer you not do this. Something along those lines.
Yes. I mean, it's part of the philosophy is we really don't want to tell people what to do.
Right.
We want to make sure that they're as safe as we can make them. And our position at the Utah Avalanche Center is we encourage people to get out and play in the snow and enjoy. But know what you're getting into. Do it responsibly. Be prepared to be responsible for your own safety.
And skiers can take training, take courses.
Absolutely.
There's to learn
so
more
many,
about how to manage avalanches.
There's so many ways Recognize to learn that. About avalanches in Utah. There's classes being taught mm-hmm. by our group, by guides like White Pine Touring, Utah Mountain Guides. There's free one-hour awareness talks that let you know where to get started. Everything from beginning avalanche classes to professional level classes, all available within an hour drive from here.
That's right. And one of your big missions is to have all school children know about avalanche in Utah. And you have that, is it the Know Before You Go program?
Yes. Yep. Know Before You Go.
Yeah. So how many kids have gone through that program? And does it happen every year, for example, here in Park City Schools?
Absolutely. It was started in 2004, so it's been in place for 10 years now. We've had about 180 or 90,000 people go through that program. I don't think you can get out of junior high or high school in the Wasatch back without going through that one-hour program. We just finished doing it at Treasure Mountain recently. We have the same session open to the public. We've got three coming up the next week, one here in Park City, one in Camas, one in Heber. Open to the public, and that's really just a teaser. It's to make people aware of what they're getting into and what they can do to get more information and learn more about avalanche terrain.
You've ever been in one?
Yes. I'm sort of embarrassed to say I've been in a couple of avalanches.
Well, you got to share. I'm one.
Kind of a slow learner.
Okay. So you made a mistake or so?
Yeah, I'd say I've been involved in two accidents, and I represent both sides of that coin. Years and probably 20 years ago, I was caught in an avalanche without really any idea what was happening. I didn't know I was at risk. I was very lucky. I took a long ride, actually almost within sight of this office, and wound up on the surface and walked away from it very shaken. And then just about the time I thought I was an expert a few years ago, I was caught in another avalanche in Alaska, and this time it was a matter of making a careful, well-thought-out decision and deciding wrong and being in the wrong place at the wrong time. And again, took a long ride, was very lucky, wound up on the surface.
We have read a lot about instances like this where, you know, was it last year or the year before in Washington, a bunch of experts and high-level people within the, I forget which resort it was.
Yeah, it was at Stevens Pass.
And, you know, a bunch of them ended up dying. And, you know, and yet all the decision-making knowledge and expertise was there. So what do you think happens to people who really know but make the wrong choice?
Well, that was a classic case of poor decision-making. As Bruce Tremper, the head of the Utah Avalanche Center, often says, the problem is humans are just a damn mess. We have all the pieces we need to make good decisions, and frequently we don't. That was a classic case of a big group of expert-level skiers. They all looked at each other and said, well, gosh, I don't feel very good about this, but if everybody else is okay with it, I must be wrong. And, you know, it's a beautiful
group,
day.
Kind of a group think.
Yep,
like
exactly.
That
was a beautiful day. There's great powder skiing, which in the Northwest is something definitely to be treasured. friends. It was, you know, there was just so many things going on that only one or two people stood up and said, you know, I'm not comfortable with this. And they did it very quietly and just sort of disappeared on their own. They didn't try to change the group.
And they didn't go with the group either.
Correct.
It's hard to stand apart from the group, especially like you say, it's a bluebird day and it's a powder day. But this is probably the most important, well, is it the most important lesson? And I think about those gates at Canyons Resort, and I think about the young people out there who, as we know, their brains haven't cognitively developed fully until they're 25 or something. And I think about them looking at that powder field of Dutch draw and, you know, square top and going, yeah, let's do it.
Well, that's such a hard thing for us to manage around here because the ski patrols work really hard at mitigating the danger within the resorts. And when you stand at a rope line looking out at something like Dutch draw, what's hard to remember is that no work has gone into making that safe. That's outside the resort boundary. That has not been controlled for you. And it's like watching grizzly bears through the fence at the zoo. You know, when you're on your side of the fence, everything's fine. You step across the fence, you better hang on to your peanuts because suddenly things have changed really quickly.
What? Okay. I thought I heard you say something. With the advent of technology, it seems like every year there's improved technology, either as far as the gear you can take in, the survival gear, the communications gear. There could be two sides to that coin. It can provide an additional measure of safety. It can also provide additional measure of
false security.
False security, exactly. Do you see that happening? That people say, "Well, I've got everything I need, and I had the course, and I've got all these beepers and things, and I got buddies. Let's go. We can do this."
Absolutely. It's that what you're talking about is actually called risk compensation. And we see it every day in our cars. We have cars with anti-lock brakes and airbags. And so we drive a little bit faster and we text while we're driving. Mm-hmm. We're used to accepting a certain amount of risk. And so same thing happens with backcountry skiers. We get better beacons. We get airbag packs. We get all these tools that help us do rescues that increase our chances of survival. And to some degree, then we push the limits a little bit further.
Right.
And it's not like we're still at the same risk. I think we're still safer than we used to be.
Yeah.
But we're not as safe as we think we are.
I'm wondering about the airbag that pops up. But talk a little bit about the most recent technology. I don't even know what they're called.
Well, airbag packs are becoming really popular. They have a lot of visual appeal. They make a lot of sense. And they're basically backpacks that you wear that have a big balloon, just like a car airbag. And when you pull the trigger, when you're in trouble and you pull your ripcord, it either uses compressed air or a fan to blow up this big bag that surrounds your head, and it floats you, in theory, to the top of the snow. In general, they work pretty well. They roughly double your chances of surviving an avalanche. The problem is, if you hit a tree, they can be torn and deflate. If you don't go a long ways, they don't have time to float you to the surface. A quarter of all avalanche fatalities are due to trauma. You know, when you hit a tree at 80 miles an hour, that's a big, big problem. And so, yeah, they definitely increase your safety. They're not a get-out-of-jail-free card.
Yeah.
Right. Hmm.
Okay. So, you know, wanted to ask about snowpack in general. You say you were involved in an avalanche in Alaska. You probably familiarized yourself as much as you could, but the bottom line is you're a Utah resident. You know about the snowpack here. And I hear that, talk about that a little bit. The snowpack every year in Colorado is different than it is here or in California or Alaska.
Yeah, the snowpack is different around the country. It even changes here day to day. And certainly that it puts you at a disadvantage. If you're in a strange area, you kind of have to dial back your risk a little bit until you really understand the snowpack. And that's something that I didn't do. Colorado does tend to have a more dangerous snowpack than Utah. And the Uintas actually have a very similar snowpack to Colorado. They're more like Colorado than the Wasatch. When we say Utah, we think of the Wasatch. So
why is that, that the Uinta range has a similar snowpack to Colorado?
Well, sort of counterintuitively, a thin snowpack is a weaker snowpack than a thick snowpack. So when the snowpack is thin, when there isn't as much snow on the ground, it tends to recrystallize, it gets sugary, it gets weak, it doesn't support much of a load. So the Uintas don't get as much snow as the west side of the Wasatch Front. Colorado's in the same position. Mm-hmm. And it turns out wind was invented in the Uintas. That's where wind originates.
Oh.
And wind is really bad for avalanche conditions. It moves snow around. It forms firm, heavy slabs. You get these hard slabs on top of this weak, sugary snow, like putting a brick on a bunch of potato chips.
Right.
And that's where you get into big avalanche problems.
Okay, so you go out backcountry skiing. What do you take?
Well, I take my avalanche transceiver. I have a probe, shovel. I have first aid gear. I'm ready to deal with some kind of injury. Some extra warm clothes if I'm stuck in the snow for hours waiting for a rescue. And most importantly, I take my brain, such as it is, and I try hard to make good decisions. And in my job, of course, it's terribly embarrassing and looks bad on a performance review if I get caught in an avalanche.
Exactly. So wanted to kind of switch directions a little bit here. You have recently written an article in Utah Adventure Journal. Is that the right name?
Yep.
And about the Mountain Accord. And so it made me wonder about, you know, part of or one of the systems groups of the Mountain Accord is transportation. And I would imagine that there are a lot of considerations that the Utah Avalanche Center has about transportation. And, you know, if you've got different roads or tunnels, I'm sure there's a vast array of considerations. Talk about that, if you would.
Well, Little Cottonwood Canyon in particular, and the Wasatch in general, is recognized as being one of the most dangerous places in the United States or in North America for avalanche danger. Because we get all this great snow, which is why we live here. We've got the steep mountains, which is also why we live here. And because there's a lot of us that recognize that and live here and want to play in the mountains and commute through the mountains and drive through the mountains. And so, yeah, avalanches play a big factor in safety. When you put a lot of people in the mountains, then you have an issue. So when we're talking about transportation solutions, we absolutely need to keep avalanche safety first and foremost in our minds. We need to think about construction. You know, during the construction phase, are workers going to be at risk? Once they come up with transportation solutions, how do you keep people safe going up and down these canyons that are exposed to avalanches?
And that road can be shut down due to avalanche
threats? It frequently
is
shut down right now, and that's a big problem.
And who makes that decision?
That's a Utah Department of Transportation decision.
And the resorts don't really have a say in that because that's money.
They really don't. And as you can imagine, that's a pretty tense decision.
Yeah.
And the people that make that decision every day cross their fingers that they decided correctly.
Yeah. And so, you know, one of the solutions is a train. There are so many different solutions. But say there were a train. I mean, the construction, where that train would be located. Say we disallowed cars at all in Little or Big Cottonwood Canyon. You know, what are the considerations of having a train? Do, you know, trains don't withstand avalanches any more than, you know, cars do, right?
Yeah, you're not a lot safer in a train than you are in a car. If you put in a train line, you have the option of looking at different routing and maybe avoiding some of the paths that roads currently go through. You have an option of putting in snow sheds or a roof that would just divert
some type
an avalanche
of deflector
over the top.
Or so, diverter.
But it's ferociously complicated. You've also got, you're working in a watershed. You've got a creek running through the middle of it. And again, I'm talking mostly about Little Cottonwood Canyon.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of considerations. It's really complicated.
Yeah. What about tunnels? You know, the tunnel comes up in the conversation of Mountain Accord.
Tunnels are obviously much safer from an avalanche perspective. I think when you start looking at the cost of both rail and tunnels, I think that suddenly makes you think twice about those as transportation solutions. I don't know. Maybe the tunnels are in our future. They certainly can help us with avalanche issues.
How many people die a year on average in Utah?
On average in Utah, about 4 people die each year.
And how many people would you say are rescued?
We typically have something.
How many calls might there be?
Something over 100 human-triggered avalanches or human involvements in avalanches. We typically have maybe 6 or 8 or 10 rescues where people would have died if their friends hadn't dug them out.
And who's doing the rescue?
it's companions, it's people in your party, or sometimes somebody from a different party, but it's not organized rescue. You've got a 15 minutes max under the snow. Not max, but generally you have about 15 minutes to survive being buried, and that's not enough time to call in a helicopter or dogs.
But if there is a life flight situation, do they pay for that? Is there a fee associated with that if someone has to be rescued via helicopter?
It's my understanding that generally, at least in Salt Lake County, and I think in Summit County, people don't pay for rescues. I think legally they can be charged for it, right. But I think that typically doesn't happen. But my memory on that's a little fuzzy. Okay.
Just want to ask you about the snowpack this year. And every morning when I've talked to either Drew Hardesty or Brett Kovernick in the last week, I'm always curious about how the snowpack lines up. And can it, once it lines up in this certain way in the fall, can it change? Can it, does it bond? What do you think about the snowpack?
Well, one of the things that makes this business so fascinating for a lot of us is the snowpack is always changing. It changes after it falls. It keeps changing all winter long. And so right now, we have a really cranky snowpack. Mm-hmm. We've got sugary snow right against the ground that fell a couple of weeks ago. Nothing is bonding very well to that. We're piling more snow up on that. It's snowing right now. We're piling heavy snow on top of it. So we're getting that brick on potato chip situation. Now, will that heal? It probably will, given the right conditions, given steady stream of more snow. That'll mostly heal. And then we'll get some storms that'll make it more dangerous and then less dangerous. It'll go back and forth. But the important thing is that it changes every day.
Yeah.
And you can't count on what you saw yesterday being the same as what you're going to see today.
It can change that quickly.
Absolutely. It can change during a day.
Really?
During the day. Yep. If it starts snowing hard, you start getting the wind blowing midday, right after a storm, conditions can change within an hour or less.
And sun and shade can have an impact too. A sunny side slope that later in the day becomes shaded can create a completely different dynamic.
Yep, and vice versa. And that's the kind of thing you learn when you take an avalanche class. It's complicated, but it's all learnable.
Right. Oh, and let's talk about some events coming up. Mm. This evening at Red Rock Brewery at Kemmel Junction, you have there's a free avalanche seminar. You have it on your website, but I think it's hosted by White Pine Touring here in Park City, and it's from 6 to 8.
Right.
It's a free lecture. And is it one of the Know Before You Go
presentation? It's not a Know Before You Go talk, but it's very similar. We work closely with White Pine Touring, and this it's a similar alternative program.
Okay. And then tomorrow night, you have a little fundraising, a fun thing.
We do. We are about two-thirds funded through nonprofit sources, donations, grants, events, things like that. And so we are having the final stop on the Powder Horror 2014 World Tour is going to be at the Prospector tomorrow night. I think we start at 7 o'clock. It's on our website. And we'll be there. We'll be selling raffle tickets. We'll be selling T-shirts and showing a great movie.
Yeah, and that's a fun thing and always great raffle items. And by the way, what is ski porn? I read this on your site.
I don't know, but I know it when I see it.
I know. There you go.
And you like it.
I'm embarrassed to say I like it.
Well done.
Okay, that's great. I wanted to just make one more comment. Okay, so I'm the kind of backcountry person. It would be one of my favorite sports were it not for the thought of being buried by an avalanche. So when I do go out, I go on very mellow slopes. In my mind, there will never be even the opportunity for me to use my gear because I will never be involved in an avalanche. That could be a fallacy. You can tell me, Lynn, it probably is.
I'd say that's mostly true. It depends what's above you.
Right,
you can
exactly.
be exposed to terrain that you're not actually on.
Right.
But your point is a good one. If you understand how to stay safe in avalanche terrain, you can go out every single day, regardless of conditions, and have a nice time and be pretty safe.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, there you go.
Well, there you go. I employ the precautionary principle at its maximum.
Stay on the tennis court.
It's not worth it. to me.
It is a beautiful, beautiful sport. It is wonderful. So, and I have learned a lot just by going on the site, UtahAvalancheCenter.org, especially after incidents, whether they're fatalities or just incidents. And you guys do a great job of uploading video from the site that says, look at this fracture line, and this is how much it is, and here's what happened, and look at this layer. And it is immensely educational and very interesting. Do a great job.
Well, thank you very much. Yes, we have a ton of information on the website. We have educational videos. We have observations from the day before. We have accident reports. Pretty much everything we can think of related to avalanches in Utah, we put on our website and our social media channels.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Paul Daigle, Executive Director of the Utah Avalanche Center, thank you so much for coming in today. And stick around. We're going to go to an underwriting break. And when we come back, before we go to our second guest, Sean Foy, we're going to talk briefly about what it is to be in the second half century of your life. We'll be right back.
Hey, friends and listeners. Join me, BC, your host for The Rock Shop on Saturday night from 8 until midnight. From the classics to the currents, I'll be getting your party soundtrack started. Only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Hi, this is Catherine Simos, president of Grand Valley Bank's Park City Branch, longtime supporter of KPCW. Our team can help you with all of your lending needs, from basic to complex loans. Our loan decisions are made locally. We have two branches in Heber and Midway and one branch in Park City. GrandValleyBank.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Chris Cherniak, my guest co-host today. Still in the studio with us is Paul Daigle of the Utah Avalanche Center. And I'm making them stick around for now because I want to hear their perspective on 50. Now, Paul, you are a genetic anomaly, I'm going to say, because I know that you're quite an athlete. But talk about when you turned 50, for example, what are some of those things you've taken into the second half?
I'd say the biggest surprise was I really expected to be a lot smarter and more mature at this age.
Right.
And I hear that from a lot of people. Somehow you expect to reach this age and be wise. And I think older people just have that illusion.
Right. Ah. Eventually. But not quite yet. Here's what I learned when I turned two things, Lynn. First, I learned that I was still as physically fit as I was when I was in my 20s or 30s. I was still as strong. I was still as fast. I could do almost anything that I wanted to do in my 20s and 30s. I could still do in my 50s. Now, that's partially because I stayed fit all that period of time, but I didn't lose much of a step,
right?
But what does happen is that your recovery period expands, and you really have to honor that recovery time when you go out and exercise and work out, and that spin class I take, it maybe takes 12 or 18 hours to recover from it, where it used to take 8 or 10. And so that you have to start to learn how to honor the recovery period and give your body more of a rest. But you can still be as physically fit and active as you were, when you were in your 30s and 40s. The other thing I learned is that someone reminded me that when we turn 50, we actually have already lived 50 years. You say you're already on your 51st year.
Oh yeah,
so,
thanks.
So when you turn 50, you've completed 50 years. So congratulations.
Well,
you didn't even
you.
Know that.
Yeah. Well, if I had done the math, I would know that. Paul, what do you have to say about that?
Well, I agree completely with Chris, and that's what I was going to say next. Is I think I'm as fit as I've ever been. I've probably been faster in my life, but I do whatever I want physically. And agreed, rest days are important. I'd say mixing up exercise. I used to be able to run every day. I can't do that now.
Right.
But I can run one day, bike the next day, and ski the day after that. I think it's important to include things like yoga, Pilates, weight training.
Even more so. Yeah, that's true.
I think that's really critical. And taking care of your back. I have so many friends that are so strong, so fast, so fit, and suddenly they've got back problems and they're bedridden, even though they're 250 marathoners, they can't get out of bed.
Yeah. Okay. That's great. I will take that into now my 51st year. Thanks a lot, Chris. All right. Let's welcome our next guest. Study after study proves the effectiveness of high-intensity interval training. Our next guest, Sean Foy, will tell us how to do it. 4 minutes to raise the heart rate and metabolism, 3 minutes of resistant training to strengthen muscles and bones, 2 minutes of core movements for the abs and back, and 1 minute of deep breathing and stretching. And the results, he says, are astonishing. The workouts boost metabolic rate, promote weight loss, target all the major muscle groups, increase cardiovascular endurance, and have a positive effect on cholesterol levels and blood pressure, and so on. Oh, and also deliver a sense of well-being. All this can happen in just a few minutes a day over there in my cubicle. It can even happen. And this guy's so fun to talk to. We spoke to him last month, but we really liked the conversation. And this was all before Tim went away on assignment, right, of course. So we're going to go ahead and rebroadcast that. Sean Foy, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me, guys.
Well, as we look through your book, we realize that we have a lot of people in common, which is we've spoken with Dr. Mark Hyman. We love his program, and we know that he ties into the Daniel Plan. We also have a local pastor a local person belonging to a church who has implemented the Daniel Plan in the church. So this is a natural progression out of this, moving into your new book, The Burst Workout. It's pretty exciting stuff.
Oh, we're so thrilled. You know, I feel so fortunate to have worked with Pastor Rick Warren and Dr. Mark Hyman and Daniel Amen. So thrilled to be a part of the Daniel Plan and all the folks there.
So the Daniel Plan it's kind of a whole lifestyle thing, along with sort of the way you live your life emotionally as well. But there's the eating component of Dr. Mark Hyman, and then your interval training component. How much does it differ from what you're presenting here in the Burst Workout?
Yeah, you know, we've actually been studying the Burst Workout in the program for, believe it or not, over 10 years now. And we were challenged, really. I personally was challenged. I had met an individual at a conference I was speaking at, and it was really interesting. She came up to me after my talk. I was speaking on fitness and nutrition and whatnot, and she said three words to me that changed the direction of my career, really, at the time. This was years ago. She said, "Sean, I'm stuck." She then went on and said, "I've tried everything, every book, every program, every pill, you name it, I've done it." She said, and then she said something that floored me. She said, "I have lost the same 60 pounds over 20 times."
Oh my God.
And I was there, and I was, again, young in my career, and I just thought I would just give her what I know today now is the blah, blah, blah. You know, in Charlie Brown, when the teacher is speaking, that wah, 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 wah. I saw in her eyes this glossy look as I began to go into my diatribe of 3 to 5 days a week of regular aerobic activity, you need to do resistance training, blah, blah, blah. And as I was speaking to her, she said, I could see her just, it wasn't registering. And she basically looked up and she said to me, she says, "Sean, I'm a single mom. I've got 3 kids. I've got 2 jobs. I just don't have time."
Yeah.
And as she was speaking, a crowd began to gather around her, and they were all nodding their heads. And they're all like, "Yeah, you know, I'm busy too." And so I realized at that moment that what I was telling them was a blah, blah, blah. And we all know it's good for us. We all know exercise is good. And we all know eating healthy is good for us. But most of us, most Americans, are not doing it. So I've realized over the years that we needed to come up with a fast fitness formula, something that people can do anytime, anywhere, that will give them the biggest bang for their buck. And that would be that literally within 10 minutes, you can dramatically change your health and your fitness, give yourself a metabolic makeover, basically. And that's what we've been doing. And we were so thrilled at the changes that we're seeing, the response that we're seeing of people dramatically changing their bodies and their lives.
So, Sean, we've kind of explored this subject with a number of people in the recent past, and Gretchen Reynolds being one of them, and she's got the 20-minute workout. And it seems, you know, everybody's trying to fit in the workout to the lifestyle. Is that what's driving this? Because there also seems to be the other side of the equation, which is the studies and the science that indicate that you can get the same benefits from much shorter high-interval workouts.
Yeah, no, it's a great, great question, Tim. I personally, for myself, after that episode with Annie, I realized that I was ill-equipped to really provide the intervention that was necessary for an individual to change not only her physical health, but also I did not have the skills to help her from a psychological perspective. So I went back to school, graduate school, to study psychology, marriage and family counseling at the time. And my master's thesis was on whole person health. This is really how it ties into the Daniel Plan, where I began to study the physical, the emotional, the relational, and the spiritual, how they're all really integrated. And what I've realized, especially when it comes to fitness and exercise, this was a huge aha for me, is when I began to see how motion, physical motion, dramatically affects emotion. That when we move our bodies, we feel better. We just naturally feel better. And the studies would show this. Dr. Amen would be the first to tell you, from a brain health perspective, from the emotional well-being that we experience when we move more, and it doesn't have to be much, to your point. It could be a small walk. It could be a two-minute stretch break. It could be deep breathing. What we discovered is just doing a little bit of activity, depression, anxiety, stress, all these areas that really many of us, I think to your point, we're so busy, we've forgotten how to nurture ourselves emotionally. And one of those things that we really need to get back to doing is moving. Most of us are sitting anywhere from 7.7 to 15 hours a day. And that is causing not only physiological issues, I really believe it's causing emotional challenges as well, to where we just have no outlet for our stress and the other areas of our life. So food naturally becomes that diversion for us. So yes, to your point, I couldn't agree more that we need to find activities. Now, I'm all for, hey, if you've got an hour, go for that walk, you know, perform activity, and that's really what differentiates this program from others. We've taken all four essential elements of any successful fitness program: cardiovascular training, resistance training, core strengthening, functional movements, and deep breathing and stretching, and put them all together into one 10-minute workout. Most workouts that are out there are one or two of those elements, but it's not all four. And that's why we really made it a point to try and get all essential elements into that 10-minute circuit.
Well, and also most workouts are maybe a couple of those elements, but the workout time is more over the course of an hour or so. And I'm thinking in terms of CrossFit, which, I think is quite similar. But even to go to CrossFit, where the workouts themselves are high intensity and short in duration, they might be anywhere from 10 to 20 minutes. You're at the gym for an hour because you've got
right.
the warm-up, you've got the instruction, you've got the cool-down, you've got the socializing.
Right.
And you're presenting a workout plan that you can really do anywhere. You can take it outside
the
gym.
Also,
you can do it at home. Lynn's doing it right now.
Yeah, to your point, really is that you can scale this workout. So our 4-3-2-1 approach, you literally can do one set, which is 10 minutes, or you could stack it and do two sets, three sets. We have some professional athletes that are doing our 4-3-2-1 workout, and they're doing 5 and 6 sets, so they can make their workout like a CrossFit training.
Yeah, it's great, really. I mean, who would know that while I'm sitting here talking to you for 20 minutes, I could be doing plank position or air squats? But it really does work, and it makes me so much happier, like you say.
Yeah, no question about it. In fact, one of the things that we've developed, obviously we've got 90 different exercises in the book, burst movements that people can participate in. We show them how to use the progression of 4-3-2-1. But this was another aha for me, guys, and that was that the best exercise, the number one exercise to help you lose weight, to help you get in shape, to help you improve your health, do you know what it is? The best one, by far.
Squats.
Well, good guess. What do you think, Lynn?
Plank.
You know what it is?
What?
You're both right. It's the one you will do.
Oh, there we go.
Right? I mean, isn't it true that
yeah.
I think here's the challenge. CrossFit, whatever, P90X, whatever the workout is that you like and that you're more apt to do is the one for you. And I'd be the first to say that. As long as it's safe and it's effective, mm-hmm. it's not going to injure someone. But I would say this, that if you can maximize the workout with the essential elements scientifically to make sure it works well and that you're going to get the best bang for your buck. I've even told clients, literally, start with a minute movement. In fact, I'd challenge your listeners and yourselves to try our 10-day challenge. It's free. It's on our website. You You can sign up for it. You get a bunch of free stuff from Dr. Amen, Dr. Hyman as well. But, you know, we're challenging people to literally move for a minute, like every hour of their day. If they could move for 1 minute, for example, if you guys were to stand up from your chairs and then sit back down again and then stand up and sit back down, you're doing a chair squat. If you did 10 of those every hour for the day, you would end up doing 80 squats for the day. Yes. Now, that's significant, especially for someone that's not been exercising. That is significant. Then we want to progress them to 2 minutes and then three, and then eventually get them doing a 10-minute workout. So we really try to apply that progressive style as trainers we really should be doing to help people improve their fitness.
Now, Sean, what about this issue of, I mean, this ties into the worst thing that we can do and that the thing that everybody does, and you just mentioned it, is we sit for 10 to 17 or 7 to 17 hours a day is what most people are doing. And Gretchen Reynolds told us sitting is the worst thing for your health that you can possibly do, and yet it's the thing that we're all doing all the time. But
Gretchen is also, 100% there's this right. Aspect. What we're finding, in fact, I'll just give you a couple of statistics. The University of Missouri has discovered if you sit for longer than 3 hours at a time, you actually shut off a lipoprotein, lipase actually is the enzyme that is responsible for metabolizing fat. And so we're literally training our bodies to store fat more efficiently. The Mayo Clinic, actually, they coined the phrase sitting disease, Dr. Levine, and what he discovered was, and their researchers, they found that sitting for 3 hours or more is equivalent to smoking a pack and a half of cigarettes a day to your health. So sitting is now the new smoking. And so what we recommend people do is this type of burst training throughout their day. I tell all of my clients, get your smartphone. We have an app that actually you can download for actually as part of the 10-day challenge you can get, where it will remind you every hour to get up and just do some simple movements. Studies have shown just getting up from your desk and standing for, again, the magic number is right around two minutes to 3 minutes. If you do that consistently, standing, doing some balance work, non-sweat movements, you can dramatically improve your health, dramatically.
And that was kind of where I was going with this, was spreading it out throughout the day, because, what is the optimal time to insert a burst workout, whether it's a couple of minutes or 10 minutes? And I guess, why don't you describe the perfect day?
Yeah, what I'd recommend, honestly, Tim, is that, in fact, what we'll do for your listeners and for you, too, is make sure you guys sign up for the challenge, the 10-day challenge on burstworkout.com, and we will literally send to you a video every day that you can follow. We're going to give you a little challenge. It'll be about a minute long, minute and a half long. Now, you can do that much more than just that 1 minute, minute and a half. For some people, though, that's a big win. If they just did 1 minute of exercise, that's more than they're doing right now. But for you guys, if you're more active, we'd love for you to do that like every other hour or every hour of your day. And as you do that, again, like I mentioned with the squat, imagine doing 80 squats for the day. That's significant. But if you wanted to make it more of a 4-3-2-1 approach, we'd recommend breaking up your interval training, which will show you how to do interval work where you're moving fast and moving slowly, then adding some resistance training, doing a little bit of core work, and then stretching and deep breathing. But to your point, you could spread it out throughout the day. You could do it all in one 10-minute circuit. Whatever it fits your lifestyle, going, Tim, back to your earlier point, I couldn't agree more. For years now, we've been trying to change everybody's lifestyle and say, no, you have to do this. And what the American populace is telling us is, no, we're just not going to do it. So we are trying to find creative ways to really get people moving more.
Yeah, Sean, even though the community that we live in, Park City, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's a very active, healthy,
beautiful, yeah.
You know, it's almost like you'd be speaking to the choir, but not really, because what we tend to do is, you know, we all go to work, we sit at the desk, if we have a desk job, and at the end of 8-10 hours, then we hop on our bikes and we ride, you know, like crazy for 2.5-3 hours or whatever
yeah,
it is,
or
we go to the gym for an hour. And what you have found out and what you're talking about in your book is that, you know, that's just not going to cut it. I mean, it cuts it on a lot of levels, and of course it's, you know, it's better than nothing, but it isn't optimum. So this is kind of a reprogramming, even, or rebooting even, for people like us.
No, you're absolutely right. In fact, the American Cancer Society did some research, and they discovered this floored me, guys. Honestly floored me. I've been spending my entire career just trying to get people to exercise more. So to your point, of all the folks there in Park City, that they're exercising, they're not the norm. I mean, the majority of Americans are not doing that. But what we're finding, though, and I'm like you guys, I'll work out early in the morning, I'll train, 5:30 in the morning, and I'll do an hour and a half workout, or I'll do it at night. But I found myself as a trainer, no longer training as much. I was becoming an author and writing. I was sitting all the time, and I really began to notice my fitness and my health deteriorating, but I was still working out. So here's what the researchers found at the American Cancer Society. If you sit for longer than 3 hours at a time, but you work out in the morning for an hour, or you work out at night for an hour, the health benefits are negated from that sedentary activity during the day.
Hmm.
That's scary.
That is scary.
Isn't it? So really, this is the point, I guess, that 100 years ago, if the three of us were talking, we wouldn't even be talking about exercise because our entire day was exercise. The problem we're having now is not only our nutritional intake, as you brought up, but really it's our lack of movement throughout the day. So what we're really trying to do with the BURS program is make it flexible enough to where people can do it during their day, they can do it during a lunch break, they could do it, in the beginning of the day, the end of the day. So we really want to encourage people to get moving throughout their day, though. Very important.
Sean, what's the importance of the journal? A while ago, I did a period of my life I devoted to triathlon training, and I found that an essential component of competing and training was keeping a daily journal. And I noticed the back of your book is a journal.
Yeah. I have found psychologically, to your point, it's essential for us to. I have found really three things that are most effective to help people with their program. Number one would be to plan their week before it starts. So what I do is every Sunday I'll sit down and I'll literally calendar my schedule and say, these are the times I'm going to be moving. This is the workout I'm going to be doing for the week. And it takes a few minutes to do, just to schedule it. And I do that on purpose because people will say, hey, Sean, can you meet? And I'll say, no, I'm sorry, I've got an appointment or I've got something going on. So I make it a priority in that regard. But secondly is tracking my progress. So literally the journal is for that purpose. I'm a big journaler. I've always written in a journal. I've always kept a journal. And it's a way that you can progress your fitness. You need to know what you're doing now so you can progress yourself to another level. That's really important. And then thirdly, this is crucial, and to CrossFit's benefit, really, and this is what we found with the Daniel Plan, is having a buddy. Having support. I don't think there's anything more efficient or effective to help you with the efficiency of your program than to having a buddy or a group of people that will do a workout with you. The social element cannot be understated. It is very important.
Boy, that is right. Well, Sean, this is all so interesting. The book is The Burst Workout. It's the power of 10-minute interval training. And take us through, if you would, before we let you go. So it's burstworkout.com that you can sign up for the 10-day?
Yes. In fact, love for your listeners. I would encourage everybody, that's listening to this program, stay skeptical. Really, go at this skeptically. You should, because there's so much information out there. But we'd love for you to take the 10-day challenge. Just sign up. It's free. When you do that, you're going to receive a daily email with a video component. You can watch the video. We'd take the challenge. We would encourage you, as I mentioned, with the social element. Let us know how you're doing on Facebook or Twitter. And then at the end of 10 days, we'd love to know how you feel. You can also get the book, The Burst Workout, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, any retailer out there. But we'd love to hear from you guys to see how you're doing.
That's right. And how about the app that you mentioned will give you a little reminder every
Yeah,
hour.
So as
that
part sounds... of the challenge, you're actually going to be able to experience that. It's called Voom, and you'll be able to download that program, and you'll actually be able to try it out and see how you like it. But I personally love it. It's on my smartphone or it's on my computer, and what it does is it interrupts me during the day, and it just reminds me to get up and do a move, and I'll either do a specific move, and it'll get me out of my chair, or it'll keep me in my chair, but do some motions that will help prevent like kyphosis, the rounding of your shoulders, for example. There's tons of things that you can do, and I love this app. It's wonderful.
Oh.
So you can, being a part of the challenge, you can have access to that as well.
That sounds fun.
Yeah.
Boy, we have had a good time talking to you. We have definitely utilized this otherwise sedentary time to get a little exercise. Well, I have. Tim's kind of just sitting there.
Lynn got at least 4 minutes of workout in while I sat on my butt.
That's right. And I am so much happier because of it. So, all right. Well, Sean Foy, thank you so much for your time today. It's been great talking with you.
Thanks, Lynn and Tim. Appreciate it.
And that was Sean Foy with the Burst Workout. We'll be right back after these words.
Support for KPCW is provided by Sundance Institute, presenting the Sundance Film Festival January 22nd through February 1st in Park City, Salt Lake City, Ogden, and Sundance, Utah. Registration for locals' individual ticket sales is now open through December 15th. For more information, visit sundance.org/tickets.
The Glitter Tent at Stein Erickson Lodge is a proud supporter of KPCW. The Glitter Tent restaurant offers regional American cuisine with Chef Zane Holmquist's seasonal menus. Located mid-mountain at Deer Valley Resort, the Glitter Tent serves breakfast, lunch, and dinner daily. Sunday brunch with live music. Reservations recommended. 645-6455.
Thanks for listening to The Mountain Life. Want to thank our guests Sean Foy and Paul Daigle of the Utah Avalanche Center. Also our underwriters, Park City Bonanza Instacare, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa, Grand Valley Bank and Heber Valley Bank, and Park Meadows Country Club. This is KPCW Park City.